Coming up, what an excellent day for the return of Mama.
Mama, why?
Why you do this to me, Mama?
Mama, what you doing up here in the scary girls' room?
My favorite, my absolute favorite, is Scary Movie 2, that little bit at the beginning. Mm-hmm. It's like, your mother's in here with us. It's like, will you get out of there, Mom? It's like, you never let me have any fun.
That's a very good Andy Richter.
Oh, it's so fun.
I mean, your impression.
Oh, thank you. Well, howdy, folks, and welcome to Minute 116 of The Exorcist Minute, a show where we endeavor to examine, extrapolate, and excavate The Exorcist, minute by terrifying minute. My name is Lester Ryan Clark.
And I'm Keenan Diaz.
And we'll be your holy guides on this journey through what some have called the scariest movie of all time. Okay, so our minute begins with Dimmy walking down that hallway toward Reagan's room alone.
And it ends with him sitting on the bed, not alone.
Yes, someone or some... one is in there with him. But let's get back to the top of this minute. He's still outside that room. He's walking to it, and this is immediately after we saw a shot of Marin in the bathroom just as his heart started acting up again. He had gotten up to go deal with it, leaving Dimmy alone. And after making us worry about Marin's health, now we see Dimmy has gotten up and is walking to that room. It's a very effective sequence, which sets us up for something bad. We immediately understand that Dimmy is making a big mistake. This is the rash young hero mistake that they usually make when the wise old mentor is not watching them. Mm-hmm. Even the way that Dimmy walks confidently to the door, opens it up, and then pauses when he sees whatever he is seeing in that room tells us something is about to go down.
I like that. Yeah, he's brash. It's even shot that way, right, from the mm-hmm. floor looking up at him like he's a cowboy or something going in there. Mm-hmm. So plot-wise, it reminds me of that scene in The Birds I was talking about where they've just been attacked by birds. They've been attacked by birds the whole movie. But anyways, so they've been attacked by birds. Swallows have come down the chimney, mm-hmm. and they're finally resting. And then in the middle of the night, Melanie wakes up while everyone else is sleeping, mm-hmm. and she hears... And she's like, well, I better go see what that is. I don't need to wake any of these people up.
No,
I need
no,
to go.
No.
Right. I'll just grab it. I'm not going to turn the lights on. I'm going to grab a flashlight and just walk up there. And man, it sure sounds like flapping. What could make a flapping noise behind those doors? And I'm making fun of it. It is a terrifying, terrifying
scene. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's like that, except, yeah, like, Karis is, it's not shot like that. It's not shot like, oh, you're making a terrible mistake. Like, Karis is going to meet his destiny, and like we're convinced, like, oh, this could be the end. This could be it. He could go and fix it.
Well, I don't know. I got a different vibe, actually.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right.
Huh. But I mean, okay, before we see what he sees, mm-hmm. we cut, and we are back in the bathroom with Marin. It is a shot of his hand frantically fishing in his pocket, after which he brings out that familiar little case of nitroglycerin pills. He sets it on the counter with a shaking hand, and then he sits and begins opening it, and even that looks difficult. He grasps a pill and he forces it way back into his throat, swallowing it dry, after which he puts a hand to his head and he lets out this sigh through his nose because his lips are still shut tight. He's still riding the pain, but now we know it's going to be all right, at least for the moment.
Yeah, this moment reminds me of that, what you were talking about a couple of minutes ago, of when you fell down those stairs and you're like, so I meant to be sympathetic. Nice. No, like pain and aging, how these things are difficult, you know,
right.
as we get older. And Marin crouches down against this, the sink. He doesn't mm-hmm. even sit on the toilet, as you might think it's doing, like, because he can't, like, that wouldn't give him enough control to open this without the counter. So he needs the counter, but like just watching him get to his like crouching position, like if he were a pitcher in a baseball game, is so difficult for him. Yeah. And like every single part of his body is not cooperating with what mm-hmm. he wants to have happen here.
Yeah. It like every month, Keenan, it's mm-hmm. something new. I'm like, oh, this thing used to be easy mm-hmm. and now it's not. And I'm just looking at Marin and I'm like, man, one day with luck, I'll be still kicking around, but it'll be really hard to kick.
So the only exercise I get now is in the spring semester because I teach improv and sketch comedy.
Ah.
And so then I play improv games with them, you know, to show them how to play the improv games. And so you have to run around a little bit and jump and, you know, and be a giraffe or a parrot or whatever.
Sure.
And so every year when that class comes around, and it's my favorite class to teach, but then after the first day, I'm like, oh God, I'm getting so old. I can't be a parrot like I used to be. Yeah. Mm. But that's the only exercise I get. So 15 weeks out of the year. But when I was in improv class, you know, at UCB, Upper East Scissors Brigade, and I went and saw my teacher's performance, Susanna Beckett, and she was not in the first group of UCB people, like with Amy Poehler and Adam McKay, but she was in like the second group. So she's been doing it for a very, very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And you know how at the end of an improv scene, the way that you know the scene is over, like one of the participants like runs across the stage, like sort of wipes it like a Star Wars wipe.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, like a swipe edit. Mm-hmm. I watched her and her team, and they're all like, you know, they've all been doing it forever. Mm-hmm. I was like, it's so cool. Like you all, you're so like part of this group mind of each other. You know each other so well. You don't even do the swipe runs. You just stand up and like everyone seems to know when the scene is over.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
I was like, wow. Yeah. It was just like, here's the line. That's the punchline. Everyone just stands up from their chairs and goes to the back. I was like, that's so cool. And she's like, no, we're just old and we don't want to run anymore.
But I mean, it might. It's probably a little bit of both. I mean,
it's probably a little bit of both. Yeah, but she says no. The main thing is no. Running is for much younger people, much younger improvers.
But that is pretty amazing. Just to be able to like be of one mind, be of like a hive mind, you know, and be able to do that.
Yeah, they've been doing it so long.
Oh my gosh, Kenan.
Mm-hmm.
If this whole podcasting thing, you know. Mm-hmm. Goes to putt, right? Wait, pot? Is it goes to pot? Goes to putt? What is
shit.
It? Goes to shit.
Goes to shit.
If this whole podcasting thing goes south,
uh-huh.
Right? You, me, Kyle, and Ian, we get together and we are an improv group and we call ourselves Legion.
I'm down. Yeah. I'm down for that.
The thing is, we can only get prompts from the audience about The Exorcist. Because we're not that good, so we'll have to like narrow our our options.
So it's like sow,
yeah,
horseman, right.
mm-hmm.
medallion,
right? Sally Fields, like, well, okay, yeah, sure,
that's fine.
Yeah. But yeah, okay, so. Okay, but yeah, we're back in the bathroom with Marin. In this shot, we begin to hear something like an ambulance siren, but the Amazon X-ray tells me that it's called Beginnings from the Wind Harp, or simply just Wind Harp. I actually checked it out on YouTube. There's like a whole Exorcist soundtrack with all the bits and bobs there. I'll post that in the listener group as well. But yeah, there's it's just called Wind Harp, and I was like, no, that's definitely coming from this particular song. So yeah,
okay.
Yeah, so
yeah, it does sound like that to me too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It was conducted by Leonard Slatkin. It's very quiet. I almost wonder if it was used intentionally to remind us of a siren. But we know it's part of the soundtrack because it bleeds into the next shot, which is back out in the hallway, looking at Reagan's door.
Yeah, it recalls an ambulance siren to me, but it doesn't make me. It doesn't prompt in me that I think it's an ambulance in the movie for like the ambulance is coming earliest, you know. So so it does both. So it's not so overt that it makes me think like, oh, someone's called the cops and they're coming to save these people or something like that. But it does feel like, oh God, there's an emergency.
Right.
So it just sort of like, yeah, in the back of your lizard brain, you've been trained to hear this siren as trouble.
Mm-hmm, definitely. So yeah. So we cut back to the hallway and to the door, except now the door is open. And Dimmy is nowhere to be seen.
Mm-hmm. Nowhere or no one.
I wonder if when we start doing other shows, we're going to have a group of very forgiving listeners.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's going to be new listeners who want to listen to people talk about Everything Everywhere All at Once or, you know, or every Disney villain or something like that. And they're like, what the fuck are these guys doing?
No, no. On the internet, people are nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're forgiving and nice. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And they like disruptions to their routine.
Exactly.
A lot.
Mm-hmm. They love it when you speak with authority on any given subject. And if you get something wrong, they will kindly and quietly remind you privately.
Privately.
You know, via email or something like that. Right?
Yeah. That's funny. That has been our experience so far. So we're just
actually has.
So we're just worried about future future listeners.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exorcist fans are lovely people.
Yeah, they're the nicest.
Yeah.
But those Disney fans are going to eat us alive.
Oh, God. They're going to eat us like the wolf wants to eat those three little pigs. But yeah, so we got the shot of the hallway and the door, but Dimmy is not there. Mm-hmm. Now, Keenan, I don't know how to describe what this sequence of shots makes me feel. You had talked before about parallel editing and cross-cutting, where we build tension by intercutting between two different scenes, and maybe that has something to do with it. But from the moment I started this minute, I have been on edge. Just seeing Dimmy walk down that hallway alone immediately after seeing that Marin is in no condition to help him, I'm like, oh, no. Mm-hmm. And then we see Marin taking the pills in the bathroom, and I'm like, oh, no. And then we cut back to the hallway. Dimmy's gone. Doors still open. And I'm like, oh, no.
Dimmy, why?
Dimmy, why? But, like, that last shot of the open door says so much with just so little. Like, just the fact that Dimmy didn't close it.
Uh-huh.
Right? A normal person in normal circumstances would have gone in and closed the door behind them. Somehow, from this shot, we understand that he's in there and something has happened so that he can't close the door. Hmm. That's the only option. He didn't, right? Because he didn't open the door, see something, and run away. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't explain it, but I feel like cinema language is telling us that didn't happen. He's definitely in there. Mm-hmm. But how do I understand that? Why can't the other thing be an option with this sequence of shots?
Yeah, I think because we would, in order to imply that he's left the room, we wouldn't want to see the room without him.
Exactly.
So we see where he had been in the hallway and he's not there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. So he leaves the door open. You're saying because he's stopped by something or somewhere in there.
Or some mother. We're running out of nouns.
I wonder about that. Yeah, yeah. So I hear you. That makes the most sense. I think that's actually what has happened here. Mm-hmm. But I've also been wondering, like, why, you know, in the script, for instance, which is all, you know, this. So what we see in the film is not in the original draft of the script from the first month or so of shooting. Yeah. So maybe Blatty helped rewrite this. We're not sure. But in the original script, Marin hurries down the hall and just sort of goes into a corner and does the nitroglycerin there. He doesn't go into the bathroom and do it himself.
Oh, interesting.
And then Karis takes the opportunity to go in to Reagan's room because Sharon comes out with bedding and stuff because she just administered this shot. So, you know, so now we have an entirely new set of circumstances, right?
Yeah. And so, I think I've mentioned on the show, folks, now more than ever is where our three, you know, our unholy trinity kind of like diverges, right? Mm-hmm. So we got the book, we got the screenplay, and we got the movie, and all three of them have very, very different, distinct types of like final battles in this final room.
Yes, exactly. So in the script, it's like, okay, Sharon has come out. Marin's not around. The door is open as I'm going in there. So, you know, so that's just very, very different. In ours, right, Marin leaves him a room. Marin is not in sight at all.
Right.
Right. So he's effectively not on stage.
Right.
And then Karis is left alone and then makes this decision heroically or full-heartedly or whatever to go in there and face some mama. Whereas the other one, he's, I don't know, you could say like, oh, Sharon comes out and he just has this sort of nervous energy and he just wants to do something. And he peeks in and he thinks if Marin wants to stop him, he's going to stop him.
Right.
But in the movie version, it is like, I'm doing this specifically because Marin would not want me to be doing this.
Yeah.
So to leave the door open there also might be like, oh gosh, like a safety thing, like Marin, you know, like I want Marin to know I'm in here if he comes back for me or something. I'm not sure.
Okay. I can see that. Yeah. So this was premeditated. It's like, I'm going to leave this door open.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Actually, Keenan, before mm-hmm. we leave this hallway, I just noticed. I feel really dumb for not noticing this.
Uh-oh.
Everything's back.
Like?
So remember when Karis first came to the house, right? Mm-hmm. Chris had had that moment with him at the bridge in the park.
Right.
And he goes to the house for the first time, and they go up the stairs, and Carl is, like, putting everything away, putting all the, changing it into, like, a museum or an asylum or, you know, something, wrapping everything up in soft, like, sheets and stuff.
Yeah,
and storing
like
stuff
moving blankets, right.
Right, right. And like, we saw that armoire, like, in the corner, and it was all, like, bundled up in like, a tarp or something. Like
yeah,
that,
the
right?
the armoire, chest of drawers, or whatever that attacked Chris.
Right. Yeah.
So you think that Carl has moved the chest of drawers and all of these things away. So instead of leaving them in the hallway, right? They've made a decision, whether that's Chris or Sharon or Willie or Carl, someone has made the decision to not just keep them in the hallway.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Which is interesting. Like why is that? Just to have more room in the hallway? Just because they are things that the demon could attack them with because they seem to have been possessed? Like, why do you think that is?
I wonder if, because it's not just that those things are moved out of the hallway, mm-hmm. it's that the hallway is dressed back up again.
Yeah,
it
with
looks,
breakable
it looks like
stuff.
A normal,
and, yeah.
With breakable stuff, yeah.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Like, you got pictures on the wall again, mm-hmm. you got, you know, like...
vases and...
Vases and vases yeah. and well, those are the same thing. but yeah, like, everything looks nice again, mm-hmm. and my initial thought was, now that Reagan is kind of stuck
uh-huh,
in that room,
yeah.
you know, for better or worse, it's like she's this is really grim, but she's coming out of there one way or the other.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's not going to affect, you know, that hallway anymore.
Yeah.
And because everybody knows that we're nearing a conclusion,
mm-hmm.
and it's going to happen in that room.
Mm-hmm.
I would imagine just to have a to reclaim a sense of normalcy,
yeah.
You would dress up the hallway again.
And Carl's got to do something with his time, I suppose. Too.
I mean, yeah, right?
Yeah. But I, you know, this armoire and this stuff has attacked Chris, and I was thinking, you know, like Carl drives it down to the edge of the river and lets it run around a little bit to this armoire. He's like, yes, play. Yes, have one last play.
Yes, and on the way, mm-hmm. like as they were driving, right, the armoire's in the front seat. It's like, where are we going?
We are going to see the Potomac. It's very lovely this time of year.
It's like, oh, I've always wanted to see the Potomac.
Right,
and you know, there's silence, but then you know, at like you just hear in the back, mm-hmm. it's like, hey, Carl.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, armoire.
I know I've never said this before, but out of all the glass skeletons walking around in large jumpsuits in that house, I like you the best. And Carl just turns up the radio.
That's right. Right. As he, yeah, he uses, you know, one hand on the steering wheel, he turns up the radio, and then uh-huh. his free hand reaches into the console and just feels the weight of those shotgun shells that he's
mm-hmm,
packed
mm-hmm.
there, rolls them around his hand a little right. bit.
And then they're at the edge of the river, right?
That's right.
And the armoire is all tuckered out, mm-hmm. right? He's like, Carl. And Carl is like, yes, armoire. Tell me again about the dust bunnies. Tell me about the dust bunnies, Carl. And Carl's like, okay, but turn around and look at the horizon.
Do we see the dust bunnies, armoire?
We are going to get our own house, and we are going to put you in the biggest room. And there will be ottomans, and there will be love seats. And sometimes, mm-hmm. when Willie forgets to do the cleaning. There will be dust bunnies. Do you see them, Armoire? Yes, yes, I hear. And then, blam! And it just falls over, right. Just on its face.
Right.
And Carl is never the same man again.
It had to be done, Carl.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it was foreshadowed in that previous chapter.
Right.
When Sharon had Burke take her spice rack out back and shoot it.
Right. Even though she still thought it had plenty of life in it, still, yeah, but they told her
there was nothing wrong with it. Yeah. They all kind of forced her hand. They kind of ganged up on her. And,
right.
And later on, you know, in that other scene, she said to Carl, you know, it's like, I was the one who should have shot the spice rack. It was my spice rack. And Carl remembered that.
Right.
People are like, what the fuck are they talking about?
Well, then you should have read it in 10th grade instead of pretending that you did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because next minute it's going to be all about the Scarlet Letter and you're not going to know what's going on.
Anyway, back
so
to the
you think
attic.
That went up to the attic? That's so unsafe.
I don't know. I don't know where it could have gone, but
I hope Carl made Willie lift that up there. It doesn't hurt his bone back. I mean,
yeah.
You're doing great, Willie.
Well, he just sits at the bottom. There's like,
yeah, exactly.
It's like, why did you bring out the lawn chair and the, and the good martini glasses?
It's been so long since I've caught up with what's going on in TV Guide.
Oh my goodness, Carl.
Potsy is up to it again. It's funny, I don't even know which character Potsy is on Happy Days.
Oh my god. Keenan.
Yeah.
Same. No.
Who the hell is Potsy?
I have watched. I mean, there was a stretch of time, right? It may have only been one summer when Happy Days was just like on, and maybe I watched it because it was like before or after Lucy or something like that, right?
Right.
And it was there, and I got real familiar with, you know, oh fuck.
You know, like the Cunninghams, Richie.
Yeah. Richie and Tom Fonz. Bosley, which is not his name. That's the actor's name. The Fonz, obviously.
Cunningham.
Oh, there. Yeah. Let's. Yeah. Right. And but like they would always be like Potsy, and I'm like, who the fuck is Potsy?
The fuck is Potsy? It's quite a name.
And I would stay and watch the rest of the goddamn episode because I'm like, I'm going to find out who the fuck is. I've watched episodes of this, and I don't know who the fuck Potsy is. Are they saying Fonzie, but with like...
No. Like, No. Fonzie is his own thing.
I know Fonzie is his own thing.
So apparently... So Happy Days lasted 11 seasons.
Yeah.
It's quite a long time for them to be in high school, if you ask me.
Yeah, well.
Richie Cunningham, who is Ron Howard...
Right.
...is only in the first 7 seasons.
Right.
So he leaves, and then it becomes about Potsy, Mr. and Mrs. Cunningham. and then the Fonz.
Uh-huh.
And then Joni's there, okay. And Chachi's there.
Yeah,
But yeah. So Potsy is in more episodes than Richie.
Is this like another, like, Baron Stain Bears? This is when we lose credibility. Like,
right.
We mess up about The Exorcist, but people are like, you don't know who Potsy is?
I don't know who Potsy is. I'm sorry.
There we go.
I know Joni loves Chachi.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah, I know Ralph Mouth.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
He's around.
I remember him.
I don't know which one Potsy
Every time somebody says Potsy, I get Chachi in my head. I'm like, no, that's Chachi.
No. That's Scott Baio.
Yeah.
All right, well, I'm glad I'm not the only one. I'm glad we can admit things to each other on the air.
Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. I've watched 400 episodes of of Happy Days, and I still can't figure out who Potsy is. And the little slider just like opens up his legs and says, "You don't know who Potsy is."
That's right. "I condemn thee to hell."
And down there, you just watch all the episodes, and even the devil is fed up with you. It's like, come on, he was in the last scene. Don't you remember who delivered the donuts? It's like, no, I don't.
If there's no Richie Cunningham, I don't understand why we're watching Happy Days.
Yeah. And he's like, yeah, I kind of agree with you. It went downhill. It's like, all right. When was the shark jumping?
Oh, that's got to be after Richie leaves.
I mean, yeah,
right. Anyway. Well, let me find out so we don't get emails.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Jumping the shark.
Is Kenan us mm-hmm. talking about jumping the shark going to be our jumping the shark?
No, probably the Mrs. Doubtfire minute we did.
Oh, okay.
Oh, no, they jump the shark before Richie leaves.
Wow. So
Richie's there for the jumping of the shark. Yeah, that's in the fifth season out of 11 seasons.
Damn.
Yeah.
And they still had enough steam to keep going.
God bless them.
Yeah, right. Anyway, back to The Exorcist. Okay, so from this hallway, we cut to a close-up of Dimmy, and we understand that he is in the room, looking mm-hmm. at whatever made him stop and look when he opened the door. And whatever it is, he does not look happy about it.
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe this look that he's given us here, Kenan?
Jeez, it's super complex. Mm-hmm. It is like not disbelief. He believes it, but like right. He did not expect this, but it's familiar.
Mm-hmm.
He's angry about it. Mm-hmm. He's trying to puzzle through, like, well, what's my move here?
Right.
And yeah, I don't know. I don't know how you could predict what this is going to be here.
Yeah, yeah. It, but the preview in his mm-hmm. own expression is enough to kind of get us like, oh god, what are we going to cut to?
It's gonna be something. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah,
yeah. Once again, Jason Miller is such a perfect subject and canvas for the shapes and colors of this movie. Half of his face is in darkness, and the other half is pale, and he looks troubled. But it's a specific kind of troubled, right? Like, Kenan, like you kind of alluded to it. It's a type of troubled we have not seen on him for a while.
Mm-hmm.
This is not the face of a frightened child who has just learned that the boogeyman is real. This is not the face of a little boy being reprimanded by his father. These are expressions we've gotten used to seeing on Dimmy's face ever since Marin showed up.
Mm-hmm.
But now Marin's not here. Dimmy is alone, and he is facing something even worse than a father figure, even more terrifying than the boogeyman, and he can't do it. We don't see him facing it. We see him negating it.
Mm-hmm.
That mask that we had so much occasion to examine on him in the early parts of the film, that mask he wore to shut everything out and keep his own feelings inside, that mask he wore when he looked at Vinnie Russell or when he was walking down that dingy street in New York to visit. Oh. We cut, and we are met with a vision, literally, of something I didn't even understand when I first saw this.
Mm-hmm.
This is obviously Dimmy's mother. She is sitting up in the bed, which is bare of blankets or pillows, just this sheet of hospital blue, and she's sitting up in the middle of that, in a hospital gown, hands folded on her lap, looking up at Dimmy with, again, not accusatory eyes, but ones that look lost and confused. Remember, we had said before that the original, you know, why you do this to me scene was heartbreaking because she wasn't so much angry as she was confused and hurt that her own son was doing this to her, that was even worse than her being angry. And we get an echo of that expression here, except now there's an element of horror to the whole thing. And to that, I want to say now that when I first saw this, I didn't know who this was. And I'm just talking about right here. Later, it becomes obvious, right? But just this shot confused me at first. I can't remember if maybe I missed the exposition at the party where she had died, or maybe it had just been so long since we've seen her character. But also, the shot itself makes her look like a different person.
Yeah.
I think of Mama Karras, and the image I get is that first scene in her home when she's so happy to see Dimmy. You know, she's sitting in that rocking chair watching him eat, right? Her face is fuller. It has more color. She looks old, but still full of life and warmth. Lots of close-ups on her face so that we can see her emotions. Even in the hospital, we could see this woman was very much still alive and feeling those strong emotions. Here, she looks dead. She's pale. She looks like she's lost a ton of weight. Her hair is whiter and just like brittle and frizzy and unkempt. She looks dead. It's like Karras is recalling the very last time he saw her in the open casket before the funeral. And that's all he can remember. Or maybe it's the strongest, the loudest image of her in his head. But what I'm saying is, for me, it's such a huge difference from her previous scenes that I had no idea who this was the first time I saw this movie. And that also made me uneasy. Same with the Pazuzu statue appearing out of nowhere. I thought the movie was communicating something beyond my understanding, some weird symbolism. And that's amplified by the fact that this shot looks like a painting. We're shooting into a corner again, and the bedposts are making these angles. The room is bare. It's a minimalist horrorscape, and everything's on the same spectrum of color. The lamp in the background is casting this weird hourglass of white that looks just as solid as the lamp. The shot has incredible depth, but also everything looks like it's on the same plane, like a painting. This is like the real-life version of Edvard Munch's The Scream. Right? Like, what do you think?
Yeah. It has this blueness to it. I mean, so here, with the blueness, we've taken out a lot of the other color elements. Like, we physically moved them out, like the yellow blanket and all that. And the second lamp that has been knocked off of the table that's nearest to us and all of that. And so, yeah, it just feels incredibly, incredibly blue. For me, it's like, this is a shocking image because, it doesn't look like Mary Karras. But for me, it just... It's like in a dream. One of my students the other day was talking about a dream that she had where her family was all there and her father was played by Willem Dafoe, but she knew it was the father, right? Like for me, I know this is Mary Karras, but it doesn't look like Mary Karras at all. She's ghostly, and the whole scene looks ghostly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so everything is stripped away, and this is his mother or an avatar of the mother. And then the only things that are left there, everything's taken out except for the lamp and the things that Marin needs for the exorcism, like his medical bag and his medical tools on that table. But other than that, everything is removed of its practicality, its utility. Everything is the dream version of itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good way to phrase it. Yeah, the dream version of it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then, I mean, I guess it doesn't really matter. It comes to the same thing either way. But do we think Howdy is doing this or Dimmy is doing it to himself? What I mean is, like, you know, I know Howdy is projecting something, right? This is Howdy, but is he creating this exact image, or is he giving off like a feeling, like a vibe? Like, is Howdy giving, you know, Mama Karras? And then in response to the frequency, Dimmy is like conjuring up this image. Like, if Marin walked in right now, would he see Mama Karras? Would he see his own mom or Clancy?
Why you quack me? Why you quack me, Lanny? Why? Yeah, in Clancy's universe. Yeah, all the verbs are quack in the Clancy universe, like a smurf.
Yeah. Marin comes in there and he's like, it's like, why is there a Christmas dinner laid out on the bed? Oh no. Oh no.
Oh, no.
Bolts from the room.
Throws himself into the oven downstairs.
Oh, jeez. Or would he just see Reagan? Mm-hmm. Right? Like, I know later when he walks in, you know, like, everyone's just seeing Reagan. But what about, like, right now in this moment, how much of this image is objective projection and how much is interpretation by Dimmy?
Yeah. Again, the script can help us or confuse us more because this shot is not in this script. It is he comes into the room after Sharon has left. There is a scene 2, 3, 4 omitted, so I don't know what would be in there. But in Reagan's bedroom, it's just Reagan. He's looking, so what he's seeing in this shot is Reagan. And it's, yeah, we just pick up there. But then the Reagan mother, it says, "You leave me to be priest to me. Oh. Send me institution. Why you do this?" So before we get the idea, and that's going to happen in our next minute of the movie, but that comes out of nowhere.
Right.
Right. As opposed to this, where maybe we're confused by this, we don't recognize Mary, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But then when it does happen, there's no ambiguity, I think.
Yeah. We like everything falls into place then. Yeah.
Right. So to answer your question, or with, I suppose, more questions, right, is this potentially Damien imagining this shot of the mother? Mm. And then that's what Howdy picks up on in order to start imitating the mother.
Oh,
right.
Okay.
Or are both of them from Howdy together?
Ah, okay. I didn't even think of that. Yeah, this could be like, he could be coming in there. That's what they say. It's like
Yoda.
Yes, I know.
Is it Yoda?
Yes, it is.
Oh, it is. I just named a random. I don't know what you're talking about.
No, there's the. I'm trying to. It has to be. It's either episode 4 or 5. No.
Yoda's
it's
not
either
in...
5 or 6.
Okay.
Sorry. Let me say that again. No.
Oh God.
It's. It must be episode 5.
Mm-hmm.
No, it has to be episode 6. Because I Am Your Father comes at the end of episode 5, right?
Uh-huh, yes. Yeah.
No, okay, no, it might be episode 5 because he doesn't understand. Okay, anyway. Now that I've managed to piss everyone off, right, even people who don't care about Star Wars, there's that scene when Luke is training and he has to go into that, like, that little grove or whatever it is, like that little... secluded area in the swamp, right? Uh-huh. And Yoda implies that this is like his greatest challenge. And Luke's like, "Well, what's in there?" And Yoda says something like "Only what you bring with you," right? And I'm not going to say what's in there.
What's in there? I don't know. you have to tell me.
It's Luke's mother sitting on a bed.
Natalie Portman.
Yeah.
No, what is it? I don't know what it is.
Oh no, he goes in there, and at first there's nothing, and then like Darth Vader comes out, and like everyone in the theater freaks out. It's like, oh my god, right? And the music's really loud. It's like, and they fight, and then he cuts off Vader's head, and then he's looking down at the head, and the face mask explodes, and it's his own face.
Oh, yes.
Right.
I remember that. Okay, yeah, cool. Yeah. Gotcha.
I'm pretty sure it's in episode 5.
It's gotta be.
I really hope, yeah. Because he doesn't know yet. Yeah, he doesn't get it. What you said made me think of that. It's like what you bring with you. So, so Demi's coming back into that room with thoughts of his mother, and like Howdy again. Like Howdy's really, really perceptive. He probably smells that. He's like, "Oh, perfect, right?"
Yeah.
I didn't know what I was gonna do, but you brought it right to my lap. Now we haven't mentioned it, but as we are looking at this, we are also hearing what sounds like Mama Karis's voice crying and plaintively asking why. The sound is distorted as if she is in a place that echoes, making me think of that room in Bellevue, which, and we talked about this in those minutes, was very much a hell on earth. And now it sounds like her spirit is trapped there with all the other poor souls crying out, wondering why their sons have done this to them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, also, and I love this, mixed in with the sound of his mother, you can hear the low rumble of Howdy's growl. This may sound weird, but I was actually relieved to hear that.
Right.
It's like Howdy's disguise is slipping just a little bit. He can't completely hide himself, right? You can see a little bit of the wolf in that sheep's clothing. And in this instance, you can be like, oh, thank God, it's only a demon.
Yeah, and I don't know if I'm just projecting, but it feels like it's the mother's voice, but I hear... like multiple voices, like multiple women. And so like, is it the mother's voice all around us, or is it like just verbatim what he was hearing at Bellevue, you know, with where the ward that she's in is a noisy, messy ward with all these women, you know,
right,
in all these different iterations of pain.
Keenan, that is a really, really good question. I actually have some notes on that in the next minute, because in that minute as well, we hear a voice, maybe several voices. And I am not sure whether it's, you know, Mary Karras and friends, or if it's just Mary Karras, like kind of like multiple Mary Karrases kind of like swirling around and talking and, you know, doing other things.
Right. I guess we haven't talked about this in a while since we talked about our dream sequence, but like, what's the difference between a memory or a hallucination? I mean, to the brain, not very much,
right?
Because they're creating what you're experiencing in real time as you're living in your whatever you call it, your lard sack that is your body, right?
Your lard jumpsuit, your lard which encases jumpsuit. Your glass skeleton. If you're my age,
yeah. So there's not that much different as it's projecting. You know, the metaphor of showing yourself a movie of your past is incomplete, but you know, your sense memory of it is being created in the present tense. It's not like pulling up files and having it directly, you know, pulling it up and pressing play or something. It's constructing it in front of you. So So what's the difference between him remembering it verbatim or misremembering it? There really is no difference.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, false memories are just as real to the brain as authentic memories.
Right. Yeah. Like, the brain, again, this is an incomplete metaphor, but the brain doesn't read memories it's stored somewhere. It only writes memories in the present tense.
Right. Yeah. Whoa. You're making me uncomfortable now. Yeah. But yeah, anyway, what was I saying? Oh, yeah. Thank God it's a demon, right?
right.
And I'm being funny, but remember, I talked about Hereditary and how it messed me up because it deals with grief in this way. It sort of like drags you kicking and screaming through one family's destruction. And for like a good chunk of the movie, you're just watching all these horrible things happen to this family, all these very horrible but very real things happen to this family. And then the demon shows up and I'm like, oh, of course. Yes, okay. They have been singled out. Now it makes sense, right? It's still terrible, but now it makes sense.
Just a different kind of terrible.
Right? Yeah, there's an evil Clarence, like, you know, looking you know, looking down from the clouds and being like, I'm going to move this chess piece, I'm going to move this chess piece. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, a little side note. We never do these. I am teaching The Raven in class right now. And I open by telling the kids that for me, and this is true, this is one of the scariest things I have ever read. I didn't understand how scary that poem actually is until reading it in class and really examining what's going on. And now that's how I open every time we look at Poe. I say, this is one of the scariest things you will ever read. And my students are like, come on, it's a talking bird. And I'm like, yes, exactly. So the poem opens and this guy is grieving, right? He's thinking about his lost Lenore. Already, I don't like it. Right, I don't like horror stories about grief. And then he starts hearing things, right? A knock at his chamber door, right? That's chamber door, by the way, not front door. So someone's in his house, right? Mm-hmm. People miss that all the time. He opens it up and there's nothing. Nothing except the whispered word, Lenore. And you get excited. You're like, oh, is Lenore here? And then Poe's like, quote, this I whispered, and an echo murmured back the word, Lenore. And I'm like, you son of a bitch. You got me all excited to see a ghost, and there's nothing there. And that's what this poem is all about, right? This guy desperately wants ghosts to be real. He wants the invisible world to be a thing, because that means Lenore is out there somewhere. Angels and demons exist, and God exists, and there's an afterlife, and life on Earth has meaning, and there's, you know, like we talked about, a larger latticework of rules and order, and it all makes sense, even if you can't make sense of it. That, for me, has always been oddly comforting, even with the existence of, you know, ghosts and devils and such, right? So then this raven flies in through the window, and this guy is already having a weird night. He's still deeply grieving, and he's all alone. So to cheer himself up, he starts talking to this raven and treating it
half jokingly, like a supernatural messenger, right? He's jokingly treating it like what mythology and superstition says a raven is, even though he knows better. And he's like, oh, tell me what thy lordly name is on the night's Plutonian shore, right? And you know, like Plutonian, right? Pluto, Hades, right? Mm-hmm. So he's joking that this bird is like a messenger from, you know, the land of the dead.
Right.
And the bird answers, nevermore. And he's like, that's a weird name. And that's the first clue right there. That answer doesn't make sense. But he doesn't stop because he's so lonely and he's so depressed and he's racked with grief. He continues to talk to this bird. And once he realizes it has only been saying that one word, nevermore, he starts specifically asking it questions where that would be the worst answer. Will I ever find peace? Is there an afterlife? Will I ever hold Lenore again? And of course, the bird says nevermore to all of these things. And the reason this is so disturbing is no longer obvious because, unfortunately, I think this poem is a victim of its own success.
Right.
And we now associate ravens with the fantastical side of this poem. But, folks, back in 1845, when Poe wrote this, it was well known, even more than today, that ravens could mimic human speech. Like parrots. People even speculate that Poe got the idea for this poem from the famous Baltimore Raven, right? Which was like a local curiosity, right? It got published in the newspaper. People would come around to see it and hear it talk, right? Quote unquote talk. And then also Dickens, whom Poe greatly admired, famously had a pet raven named Grip, who could also quote unquote talk, and who became a character in Dickens's novel Barnaby Rudge. And get this. One of the things Grip would say in Dickens's novel, published in 1841, was nevermore. So when Poe writes The Raven in 1845, readers weren't like, oh, this is really spooky. They were like, oh, this is really sad.
Mm-hmm.
Because more than we do today, they associated ravens with mimicry. They knew that this was a thing that ravens did. And to make it even more obvious, Poe's raven is quoting Dickens. So the true horror of Poe's poem lies in the ambiguity, right? The raven could be a messenger, an evil spirit with bad news, or even worse, it's just a bird. No ghosts, no devils, no God. The narrator is truly alone, talking to nobody. I wish I still thought it was a poem about a demon in a raven disguise, but hey, that's what The Exorcist is for. Right? Good news, everyone. Captain Howdy is real.
Yay. All right. That's interesting, Lester. I think I have misread The Raven, so I got to go back and read it. But that makes a lot of sense based on, you know, his lesser known pieces that I remember learning a lot about in school and being like, these are comedies, you know, these are meant to be funny and until they're not.
Right.
That's what Hop Frog is. Yeah. That's what The Black Cat is. Mm-hmm. That's what The Cast of Amontillado is.
Yeah.
But for some reason, yeah, I've never thought about The Raven that way, which is his most famous piece. So I have to go back and look at that. Yeah. Like it's supposed to be like, oh, this is silly. This is, you know, this is, because, well, yeah, when people read this nowadays, they're like, tell me what their lordly name is on the Plutonian shore. And they're like, they read it as horror.
Yes. It's like a non-Catholic priest, like, demanding the name of the demon, right?
Right, exactly. Right. But that makes a whole lot more sense. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what happens in the Poe pieces, I guess, except for even The Pit and the Pendulum.
Mm-hmm.
No, even in The Telltale Heart, right?
Right.
It's supposed to be funny and like, oh, yeah, they all have twist endings where you realize if not like, oh, it's a surprise, it's like, oh, this is about really deep things.
Right.
And it only works because it hasn't been about deep things before.
Right.
It's
it goes from
something else.
Yeah. It goes from 0 to 100. It goes from like really, really light to really, really heavy.
Yeah. That's so interesting. Yeah. I got to reread it again. I think I take it for granted. Yeah. Because it's so famous and I must have read it, you know, dozen times so far. So
my favorite reading, I mean, you know, it's got to be like above all the others is James Earl Jones, you know, which I first heard in the Treehouse of Horror.
The Simpsons, right?
Yeah, right? And then they started talking about the Raven.
Oh, like the movie The Raven, the Vincent Price movie.
No.
Oh.
No. yeah. But yeah, so like, anyway, guys, that's what I'm saying. I'm trying to say that
the growling of Howdy in this scene, mm-hmm. ironically, put me at ease.
Because
I'm like, oh, this is a sham. This is a skit. This is a sketch. This is fraud. This is like fake. You know,
and it's like, so rather than Damien having to go to therapy and solve this and fail for the rest of his life, he uh-huh. can just beat up the demon and then it's done.
Yeah, there you go. Right?
Yeah. He can just solve it through plot and not through through emotional arc.
Exactly. Right?
Much easier.
Yeah. But yeah, so we cut back to Dimmy and we can see that he sees it's a trick, mm-hmm. but that doesn't make it any easier for him.
Right.
Like you said, Kenyon, he is fighting it. He is fighting the urge to feel. His mm-hmm. His story is so sad, right? He has been closed off for so long, and Chris and Marin get him to open up in this movie, and now he has to guard himself once again. So after a moment of steeling himself, he begins to move.
Mm-hmm.
And so our camera follows him as he goes from the foot of the bed to the head of the bed. As he walks, he passes through various degrees of light and shadow, all the while his eyes are trained on the thing in the bed.
Mm-hmm.
But then we cut, and we see what's actually in the bed. Reagan, or Howdy, is lying there, arms tied, splayed out in a cross, staring up at the ceiling. Reagan's face is bathed in a cold sweat, and she is shivering pitifully as her breath hitches and shakes. It's almost as if Dimmy's choice to move closer dissipated the illusion, and now he can see the reality.
Mm-hmm.
But what's actually going on here? I wanted to ask you this, Keenan, because this looks really pitiful.
Yeah.
So at first I thought, oh, this is Reagan. We're getting a brief glimpse of Reagan, and she's cold and she's afraid. But based on what happens next, I'm not so sure. Is this another sham by Howdy, or is he legitimately shivering and suffering because of the exorcism?
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. Pitiful, which is what I was thinking too.
Mm.
And yeah, it feels like Reagan until you not only talk about what's going to happen in the next minute where his brain is still on, but before we started recording, when you came into the chat today, I was like, oh, sorry, I just was watching The Exorcist because it just propels you forward. So I got to the point where Howdy finally leaves Reagan's body, and you could see the difference in Linda Blair's performance.
Right.
So I guess, yeah, I'm cheating by looking ahead and saying like, no, this is not Reagan shivering. This is still Howdy. There's a pretty distinct difference that you see when it becomes Reagan again,
right? Yeah.
But yeah, the shivering part of it, I don't know, I was thinking about that. It's they're cold, but she's been stuck in here for a longer time, so she's just by their very nature colder than the rest.
We're talking
of
about
them.
Linda Blair or Reagan?
Reagan, I guess. Yeah, okay. Linda Blair gets to leave the room every once in a while.
I mean, like, there are those horror stories about like her like having to like be in that bed, like being the coldest one in that.
Yes,
set. Yeah,
for sure. But then think about Howdy, the reality of it, or Reagan Howdy, right? That has not left the room for even longer than that.
Oh, right.
Know?
Yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. but. But yeah, the shivering of it, and then there's something about shivering as you get older, like as you age, where old people, like not you and me, but like actual old people,
okay,
like the because shivering is this this automatic system, right? It happens automatically, rather. You don't think, hey, I need to trigger. It just happens. You know, your body takes over and is trying to defend itself. But that older people can't shiver as well, and so they're more susceptible to cold.
Oh.
So because their muscles no longer work in the same way. So I was thinking about, as the old mother shivering, you know, sitting there, she can't shiver if she is cold. You know, she's not real, but I was still thinking about that, about that poor woman in this cold space. And then like seeing what she really is, I suppose, as Captain Howdy. I don't know if that makes any sense at all because she's not real. But she wouldn't be shivering in that room if she were there, or she'd have more trouble shivering.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Oh,
that poor woman, Dimmy. What have you done?
Why you do this to her, Dimmy? Yeah. But yeah, so we cut back to Dimmy, and it looks like he is affected. That mask has fallen off as quickly as it has come back on, revealing a concerned expression, concerned for Reagan. He moves the rest of the way. To me, that the distance from the foot of the bed to the head of the bed seems so long in these shots. And he sits down on the bed beside her.
Mm-hmm.
After a moment, he turns and he reaches for something on the nearby end table. And that is where our minute ends.
I like that we end with Dimmy working through his initial fear so that he can help Reagan. Mm-hmm. For now, that is all of my notes. Keenan, is there anything else? For now, that is all of my notes. Keenan, is there anything else?
No, I think we got it.
All right, folks, this has been another excellent Exorcist Minute. I've been Lester Ryan Clark. You can reach me on all the socials as Lester Ryan Clark.
And I've been Keenan Diaz. You can find me on Instagram and Letterboxd at Howdy Keenan.
Yeah, we got our listener group, Compelling Conversations. Go check that out and request a join. Go check that out and request to join, and we'll let you in here with us. Thank you so much to everyone who has shared the show by word of mouth or on social media, and a big thank you to everyone who has given us a 5-star rating on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you listen to our show. We really appreciate that. It's going to help our little podcast grow and find more cool people like you. Okay. Keenan, are you thinking what I'm thinking?
I think I am, Lester.
All right. Potsy, yeah.
Mm-hmm, yeah, yeah.
Folks, until next time.
The power of Potsy compels you. Wherever the hell that is. I just read the, while you were talking, I read the Wikipedia article for him. Uh-huh. I still don't remember who he is.
Is there like a blank picture next to his entry? Like all the other ones got like little thumbnails, but like his is just like,
right.
His is that generic one with like a, you know, like a silhouette with a question mark for a face.
Exactly. Poor Potsy. Yeah, this says Joni loves Chachi. Uh-huh. No one remembers Potsy. That's not very nice.
Wow.
That was a spin-off.
Keenan, are we stupid? Is Potsy, like, is that the joke? Is there no Potsy?
He's just an interesting, he's like Maris on Frasier.
Right.
It is such a cool name, yeah.
Right. Or like Mr. Hooper on Sesame Street or something like that.
Well, he was Mr. Hooper died, didn't he?
No. We can always go see him again. he died.
Yeah, Mr. Hooper was a real.
When's he coming back?
Soon, Big Bird. Soon. Just look out there at the horizon. You see where the street. You see where the street meets that backdrop that looks like more streets, but isn't.
Down to the place where the air is clean?
That's sure, sure. Oh.
Yeah.
There's no guns in Sesame Street,
no.
So he just has to just slowly beat him to death with the lid of a trash can. Takes him a couple hours,
wow.
But Big Bird is super willing to play along.
Jeez.
What, you'd rather there be guns in Sesame Street?
No,
is that what
no.
You're saying?
I mean, I was thinking like, you know, whatever letter it is that episode.
That's right. Strangles him with the capital Q.
There you go. Yeah. God. Jeez, this guy. I think that might be the line where people are like, you can make fun of this, you can make fun of that, you can make fun of Sesame Street.
No, we're making fun of Potsy. This
oh,
is a
yes,
Potsy thing.
That's right, this is the Potsy thing.
Right.
Fuck Potsy.
Well, it's not quite a Ralph Mouth.
And it's not quite a Fonzie.
But boy. Oh, so to answer your question, I don't know.
Nah.
Good.
Do you remember that episode when Potsy got sick? And everyone was talking about him. We couldn't see him for the entire episode. Or do you remember that episode when Potsy was overseas in the war?
Yeah, he fought in Korea, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Or that episode where he had jury duty. And then there was the one where he was on the witness protection program.
Right.
And then there was Potsy's dream, which of course didn't feature him.
Right. It was all first person.
Exactly. Yeah. Then there was that one episode where Mr. Cunningham takes Richie, you know, out to the lake. And he's like, so you've been asking about Potsy, right?
He's like, yeah, Dad, I just, you know, I haven't seen him around lately. He's like, well, I'll tell you where he is. You just look over there on the horizon.
Are you sure, Dad? I can't see him.
No, just keep looking.
All right, Dad, I guess I'll just keep looking out here for Potsy.
Yeah.
Oh, there's somebody. I can't quite make out his face, though. Doesn't have a lot of
Wait, making out? That
features.
Makes me think of... 90% of the jokes on the show. You know, I was David the Gnome after this.
Don't confuse people with Tom Bosley credits.
What was that, Dad? Nothing, just turn around. People confuse me with the guy who founded Wendy's. But that's not me. His shotgun is louder.
Is what, Dad?
All right. Wow. Like we went through this whole thing. We didn't make any Fonz jokes.
We don't need any Fonz jokes.
Yeah, we don't need any Fonz jokes.
Except at the funeral and Richie's funeral. Fonz comes in and, you know, Fonzie knew it had to be done. Mm-hmm. But he's still angry at Mr. Cunningham, right? He's angry at the whole situation. He's got his leather jacket on, and he's so full of rage, and he just punches something, but it's the jukebox, and it starts playing Rock Around the Clock.